daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Hello and welcome to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Coming up, Chinese Premier Li Qiang meets Tesla CEO Elon Musk in Beijing. What message does the meeting send out? Israel says it may delay assault on Rafah in exchange for hostages. But what are the main challenges there in reaching such an agreement? And pro-Palestinian campus protests are spreading from the US to Europe. What are the demands of the student protesters? Chinese Premier Li Qiang says China's huge market will always be open to foreign-funded enterprises. He made the remarks while meeting with Tesla CEO Elon Musk in Beijing. Li said Tesla's development in China can be called a successful example of China-US economic cooperation, adding that equal cooperation and mutual benefit are in the best interests of the two countries. Musk said Tesla's Shanghai Gigafactory is the automaker's best-performing factory and expressed his willingness to deepen cooperation with China. For more, we are joined by Dr. Zhou Mi, Senior Research Fellow with Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economic Cooperation. So first of all, what do you make of the significance of Elon Musk's recent visit to China, particularly his meeting with Premier Li Qiang, and what message does it send out?
I think that he was invited by the Chinese officials to discuss about the situation, about the new energy industries. We know that right now we are seeing there are so many chaos about the message that whether there is some overcapacities in China's EVs sectors or other issues. A lot of investors are just wondering whether it is true that from some of the Western media that China has a lot of problems on welcoming the FDI from other countries. So Elon is trying to, use his own eyes to look at what is the situation now and whether he wants to further explore the opportunities here in China. I think his action is one of a very good message to a lot of investors. And also, the EVs and also some related sectors, there are so many small and medium-sized enterprises. They can try to rely on or depend on the cooperation with the giants like the Tesla. So I would say that it is a real good news for both Chinese domestic investors and also the investors from other countries.
Yes, and Premier Li described Tesla's business in China as a successful example of economic and trade cooperation with the US. So what factors do you think have contributed to this success?
It is true that, when Tesla came here in China, invested in Shanghai, it is a really important time for them because it cannot fulfill its commitment as automatically produce so many EVs to provide for the consumers. Well, when he did that in Shanghai, I think it's a really good improvement on the cooperation between US investors and also the Chinese some of the factories. So I would say that many factors are really important for this cooperation. First of all, both Tesla and also China were really open to cooperate with each other on try to develop and make better improvement on the technology. Well, the second is that we should try to focus on the economic cooperation. The economic cooperation is really important. Do not think too much about the politics or other factors. We are only focused on the innovation, on the productivity, and these are really important for us to get better success. And third, I would say that it is not only important, but also crucial for the invention, based on the very sound base and also better mechanism to supporting this development. It is not only about the ideas, about how can we fulfill, what we can imagine and try to make it into reality. It's a very nice place to invest in China.
Well, Musk's visit coincided with the removal of restrictions on Tesla cars in China after meeting the country's data security requirements. So how significant is this development for Tesla's future in China? And does this set a precedent for other foreign companies operating here?
We know that the digital economy is still in the very early stage. So a lot of practices and also laws and regulations are not that perfect. I think that during this procedure, we are trying to make it better to fit for different requirements, like for the the feasibilities of the users and also the security consideration of the government. I think it's really some of the balance point we need to find. From the example of Tesla, I think it's very important for them, because when they are able to get better access to different occasions and places in China, it is much better for them to make better use of the integration markets and trying to provide a better service based on the the accumulation of the development of the technology. And I would say that it's also a good example for us, not only for Chinese companies, but also for investors from other countries to think about the possibilities of the development for the new things. And it's an exploration of new areas based on the innovations.
Yeah, and do you think this is also a message to the U.S. government, considering the challenges faced by companies like TikTok in the U.S. right now?
It's I think that maybe they should think about that. They should not only use a lot of excuses based on the national securities, but also try to think about the demand of the market. So it is when we are touching some of the unknown areas, I think maybe the government have something not so confident. It's true, but we should think about that, about the possibilities of interactions. We should not only judge a lot of issues based on the ideologies or perceived some of the false facts. That is not good for the consumers, but also for the society development.
Right. And considering the rise of domestic competitors like BYD and the growing interest in EVs from Chinese tech giants like Huawei and Xiaomi, how do you perceive Tesla's position in the competitive landscape of the Chinese EV market?
I still believe that Tesla is very competitive, because it's not only our producer of the EVs, it's also a producer of a lot of area-related areas like the autopilots and also the development of integration of digital resources and make it better connected with the environment. So EV is not only our vehicles, for the people to travel, but also our the entrance for the data. So we can provide the people with a better using experiences by the development and integration of a lot of similar environment. I think Tesla is also one of the very good player in China's that can cooperate with many of the China's companies. Some of them are small and medium sized ones.
Yes, and Musk's visit also raised expectations on enabling Tesla's full self-driving in China. How do you assess the feasibility and also the timeline for the rollout of this technology in China?
Maybe it is the future, because the AI and also some of the technology has the abilities to support the vehicles to have a better improvement by the less accidents and the much safer roading, the experiences and traffic management. But it's not that easy in many of these countries. Well, in China, I think it's much more possible for them to develop the better and the better experiences on using the autopilot, because many of the China's, the cities are trying to develop the autopilot experimental zones for some of the enterprises to develop the better experiences. Well, Tesla's technology route is different from many of the EV makers. It's using cameras to capture and trying to use the algorithm to make it better to optimize the ways of making the driving possible. So I think that is possible maybe in some of the areas in China, because many of the Chinese, the consumers are really trying to experiment some new things, and they are really good at that. I think it's one of the very special characteristics in China compared with many other countries.
Okay, but will data security be a major concern for enabling this technology?
Well, security is always there, but how can we guarantee that any of these actions be related to the security? I think that the best way of dealing this is not trying to forbid this happen, but trying to make a better regulations and also giving some of the standards or criteria for enterprises who are involved in these areas. We also are able to provide the region limited experimental areas for some of the tests to start first. Actually, we are exploring a lot of unknown areas, and many of them are still very potential, but maybe there are some dangerous. If we cannot handle that, they will just be well overwhelmed by the development of the technology. So we need to start from some of the areas at the first, and Tesla is one of these area explorers in many new areas.
Yeah, and by the way, while some CEOs occasionally meet with high-ranking government officials, Elon Musk's meeting with Premier Li Qiang seems like a significant interaction. So in your experience, how common is it for business leaders to engage with Chinese officials at this level? And does it suggest a potential evolution in the role of business leaders as potential diplomatic bridges between nations?
I don't think it will be a routine for the company's owners to meet with the higher officials. But when the time is nowadays, I think that maybe this is a very important signal for the the communication from the private sector and the government. Maybe in the future, when everything goes well, I don't think it's necessary to to meet with the high official directly. But if we are exploring some new areas, some maybe very sensitive or some of these unknown areas, it's important to send some message to the market first. So I would argue that it will be one of the normal practices to deal with the problems or solve these problems from the top level. Well, if the market are functioning well, I believe that it is getting better and easier for the different persons to solve the problems on the development. And this habit is really important for us to have a much more efficient ways of dealing with different situations.
That's Dr. Zhou Mi, Senior Research Fellow with Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economic Cooperation. This is World Today. Stay with us. This is World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. A Chinese economist says he anticipates greater international cooperation in new energy vehicles. Professor Cao Heping at the School of Economics, Peking University, made the remarks at the 2024 Beijing International Automotive Exhibition. In the interview with Song Ruixin, Professor Cao noted that the U.S. should cooperate with China to achieve common interests rather than use protective national policy against open markets and worsen the situation.
Professor, the 18th Beijing International Automotive Exhibition is themed New Era, New Cars. What can consumers expect from this year's Auto China?
You can see during the past few years, the new cars with a much cheaper cost compared to the traditional oil cars. So the consumer this year, they don't need the much cheaper when one charge the electricity fees. However, they will expect the car with a short time to charge. And one charge can run over 1,000 kilometers. That means the run mileage can 1.5 or 2 times of the traditional cars. And with much more fashionable designs, the Chinese new consumers, they are younger, so they will expect some new cars looking more fashionable and compared to the old cars, attractable to them.
Among the highlights of this year's event are the unveiling of China-exclusive concept cars and the debut of special or limited editions explicitly tailored for the Chinese market. Beyond those offerings, how are automotive companies addressing the preferences and demands of Chinese consumers?
In China, quite a few policy is already encouraged new consumers, no matter what types of age and income cohorts. They will expect the new cars will give them more comfortable, low cost, and fashionable design. So with regard to the supply side, the automotive companies should remember that the new cars market in China actually triggered out a new preference of consumers. So they demand or they expect a car with an affordable or a little bit more expensive, such as 30,000 renminbi yuan, can buy a car, something like the Mercedes Benz or the BMW cars. So the company should pay much more attention about this demand or consumer preference change.
According to International Energy Agency estimates, the global demand for NEVs will reach 45 million units by 2030, 4.5 times the 2022 figure and 3 times the 2023 figure. Current production capacities are still far from meeting demand. How do you perceive the current Biden administration's stance on EVs from China?
You can see the US a little bit fears that the Chinese export could harm the US interests. However, I can see the existing market or the world cars total amount accounting about 800 millions. 45 millions increase will account about 5% of the new market. So if US car industry only accounted about 10% of world share. So the new cars will account about 5% of the world share. That means US unilaterally will do some things without the cooperation with China market. US position right now could be manageable if China's car export with a good relationship with the Europe and the rest of the world.
If we look at the data, the IEA's Global Electric Vehicle Outlook 2024 report shows that China accounted for 60% of all EV sales in 2023. How exactly did China manage to achieve this?
That's a good question. The Chinese cars compared to the last year, they will account about 6% of the old sales. That's because China's new electricity cars, their industry is fully capacitated from the raw materials to the industrials to the battery industry and the chips. All this kind of portion of the industrial needed that's in China is fully grossed. In this year, the China's new cars, the capacity will expand with much faster rate. If the market is working well without any outside shocks, this year, the Chinese car sales with regard to the global market will account larger portion of the market.
Given growing demand and potential regulatory challenges, can Western companies replace Chinese products?
With regard to the new trend, for example, the NEV cars, I can't think the West companies in a position to replace Chinese products. That's because the new cars basically 100% not traditional cars. For example, the traditional oil cars up to two parts or the components will run about over 8,000 to 12,000, that's range. However, the new electricity cars, that's only about 4,000 components. The components is quite different. For example, with regard to the engine, the oil engine, the old cars one. Currently, the new cars, the electric engines, about four. Each engine's right connected with each wheels. The manufacturing process and the components and the electricity chips quite different from the old ones. In China, though, there are some engineering says that the new cars basically is a mobile phone with four wheels expanded to a car size. That means if the old or traditional car companies do not try to catch up this trend, the old cars can't compete with the new cars because first, it's much cheaper. For example, one electricity charge, if you do it in your house, it's cost only about $5. If you charge it in the commercial stations, it's only about $15. However, if you fill the tank of the traditional oil cars, you will need about $60 to $70. The consumer definitely will choose the EV cars. They don't choose the oil because they're much cheaper. Secondly, in China, you can see the commercial station, if you ask a Chinese company to build up the charging infrastructure for a Chinese company, they will do it much easily. However, if we go over to the US and other Western countries, this charging station costs a lot for the US and Western Europe to do it. So I consider the replacement of the car market by the other countries can't compete with the Chinese right now. Maybe within 18 months or later, the traditional car company catching up, they will do it better. I found in China right now, you can see the Japanese cars, for example, the Toyota and other two companies, they will run a joint venture company with the Chinese automakers. That's doing a similar things in the 1980s or 1990s. The US and the Germany's cars company with the Japanese company, they run a co-manufacturers, share the company and share the market. I consider this is a good choice for the traditional old companies.
What strategies or initiatives can be implemented to overcome those challenges?
Currently, only it's very beginning phase. So that means if Chinese and the Western car company working together, for example, run more joint venture or joint venture research branches together, sharing the holders, I think the world market could, with a smooth or stable transition from the old status to the new one. With Chinese car makers, I consider we should use a more open policy, welcome the foreign companies moving to China to participate in the new cars manufacturing and market expansion works. Domestic and foreign companies should be implemented both inside and overseas. The joint venture shareholdering, the co-research branches, and come together to design the new future models. More importantly, Chinese company could with foreign companies to build up the electric infrastructure, charging infrastructures with worldwide networks. This could let the China and foreign companies working together to expand the market and to share the interests. I don't agree with currently the national, a few of countries that use the national policy with the counter against the open market policy. That will make the situation worse. So I think the China and the US should working together and also welcome the other countries joined into this new international network to manufacturing cars and to share the data and build up the new or the future economy.
That's Cao Heping, professor of the School of Economics at Peking University, speaking with my colleague Song Reixin. You're listening to World Today. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Israeli airstrikes on the southern Gaza city of Rafah have killed at least 22 people, including 5 women and 6 children. At the same time, Hamas leaders are heading to Egypt for a new round of ceasefire discussions. Israel's foreign minister said over the weekend that the country could suspend its planned operation in Rafah if a deal on hostage release is secured. For more, we are joined by Dr. Tim Manderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, a Sydney-based think tank, and he's joining us from Damascus. Dr. Anderson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So how do you assess the feasibility of this of the proposed deal for a ceasefire in exchange for the release of Israeli hostages? And what do you think are the main challenges in reaching such an agreement?
Well, I think it's true that the mediators have put in a lot of work to try and reach agreements, and they've been almost at the point of agreements. But one of the intractable issues here is, you know, of course, when you talk about the hostages, we're talking about a prisoner exchange, effectively, because there are many thousands of Palestinians in Israeli prisons, many of them without charges, you know. So really, it's always been an objective of the Palestinian resistance to bring about some sort of prisoner exchange, which the Israelis resist, and they consider that their so-called hostages are the only people who are really wrongly held. The problem, the underlying problem here, though, is that the Israeli regime, the current government under Netanyahu, is really sees that it only has a future if the war goes on, effectively, if the offensive goes on in Gaza, because Netanyahu is widely blamed for the failures of the recent uprising, the failure to predict the recent uprising. He's very unpopular, and it's widely believed that he is going to be out of office and facing corruption charges, possibly in jail, when the war ends. So getting some sort of result out of the war or perpetuating the war is in the interests of Netanyahu and his cabinet at the moment, and that's really one of the reasons why the Israeli side has been so intractable in these discussions.
Okay. And according to the White House, Joe Biden has reiterated his clear opposition to an invasion of Rafah in a conversation with Benjamin Netanyahu. While in the meantime, we know that Blinken is on his seventh diplomatic mission to the Middle East since the war began. How do you look at the U.S.'s role in mediating this conflict, and how much leverage does it still hold over Israel?
Yes, well, I think you've hit an important point in talking about the US role in mediating the conflict. The US presents itself as some sort of mediator, but in fact it's a sponsor of one side. And that's always been, that's a general contradiction, you might say, in the US role in the region. The US has very specific interests in the region, and the Israelis are effectively set up and sustained by the US, by US finance, by US weapons, and by their network of alliances and so on. This war on Gaza is only going on because there are more weapons being provided to the Israelis. So we have to take with a grain of salt when they say that they are opposing what they're doing in Rafah. They're providing the weapons, the planes, the wherewithal to carry on this war against the largely civilian population in the south of the Gaza Strip there. And I don't think we can ever really consider them as genuine mediators in this conflict, because they are so clearly the sponsors of and deeply committed to and really effectively the parent of the Israeli colony in occupied Palestine. So in terms of leverage, of course, I think many commentators have said this, people involved, that if Biden really wanted to stop the offensive on Rafah, he could do it with a phone call. It would happen. He would say no more weapons, no more money. And the Israelis, let's remember, are going back to their sponsors for legal help too with their problems in the International Court of Justice, as well as the ongoing finance and weapons which are keeping this war going. So I think that the idea that US is somehow mediating is rather a bit of a myth, really. The US has clearly taken sides.
So if Israel does move ahead with the operation in Rafah, do you think that's going to affect the US's support for Israel?
It makes it more difficult for the US to openly support the Israelis when they're committing serious crimes. That's clearly been the case for a number of months now. They're trying to backpedal. They're trying to make out that they are at arm's length. They are not at arm's length. They have been very deeply involved. I mean, President Biden said recently that we have a major operation in Gaza. You know, there are U.S. Personnel involved in the planning, the operations in Israel. We know there are warships there that are integrated with the U.S. military. We know that they did the large part in shooting down the missile attack that came from Iran in retaliation for the attack on its embassy in Damascus, for example. The US are very deeply involved in this operation, but they are also trying to manage their image to the world, because they know that they've been suffering the US image has been suffering just as the Israeli image has been going down in the world in recent months.
Yes, and Netanyahu has stated repeatedly that their goal is to eliminate Hamas. But will an invasion of Rafah effectively achieve Israel's goal of eliminating Hamas?
I don't think anyone believes that. It's said from time to time, but even Israelis have admitted that it's just not possible. Hamas is very deeply embedded in the structures of Gaza society. They've been effectively the regional government for some time. So I don't think that really, I mean, the Israelis have said contradictory things. They've said that everyone is responsible for the militant resistance there. Remember, Hamas is one of about half a dozen armed groups that is carrying out this armed resistance against the Israelis. When they do the ground invasion, of course, when they're bombing from the air, there's not much the resistance can do. But when the ground invasion happens, there is still quite strong armed resistance from Hamas and also the Popular Front, the Islamic Jihad. There's several other groups that are involved in this resistance. Hamas is just the leading group here. So the idea of wiping out Hamas or armed resistance in Gaza is really impossible. And no serious commentator really believes it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Dr. Tim Manderson, Director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, a Sydney-based think tank. You're listening to World Today. Stay with us. You're listening to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. University students across the United States have vowed to continue their protests over the Gaza conflict. Police have clashed with students on several occasions and arrested hundreds. Poppy M. Putting has details from Washington.
It's been a little over a week since students at Columbia University in New York City set up an encampment in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza and to call for an end to the war. Police arrested more than 100 students after the university president called them in to disperse the protesters. In a matter of days, encampments sprung up at universities across the U.S. and are continuing to pop up more broadly. In most cases, administration officials called in law enforcement, with some interactions with student and faculty protesters getting violent. The encampment at George Washington University in the nation's capital is one of the latest to spring up. Students have been here since early Thursday. Despite the university's call for them to disperse and the academic suspension and campus eviction of a few, the students say they're here to stay.
I personally am a Palestinian American. I've lost family in Gaza because of the genocide, and so I'm here to show my solidarity with Gaza and to be a voice for my people and to ask GW to divest in any companies that are aiding that genocide.
I will admit, in my lifetime, I never thought I would see a free Palestine. Never. Yesterday, I had a slight glimmer of hope. So I am hopeful now.
What was the the glimmer of hope? What was different?
Because of these encampments that are spreading like wildfire. They are what's giving me hope.
There are hundreds of protesters here outside George Washington University. Some are students, some are community members. They're here to support the student protesters who are currently inside that encampment. They say that they will stay here in solidarity for as long as it takes for the university administration to give in to their demands, some of which include divesting from Israel-linked companies, as well as ending the war in Gaza immediately. For now, the protests have been largely peaceful and the police are staying back.
That is Poppy M. Putting reporting. In the meantime, pro-Palestinian protests have spread on campuses from the US to the UK and France. For more, we are joined on the line by Timo Kivimaki, Professor of International Relations at University of Bath. Professor Kivimaki, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
So first of all, what factors do you believe have contributed to this widespread scale and intensity of pro-Palestinian protests on university campuses across the U.S.?
Well, I think it is 99% because of the sheer nature of the U.S.-supported Israeli operation in the Palestinian areas. There is a contradiction between what people think as humanitarian norms and what they are seeing in Gaza. the number of fatalities among civilians, the number of fatalities among children, and the destruction of civilian infrastructure, all this is unprecedented and does not match with the justification of this conflict as mere counter-terrorism. People do not think that children and civilians are terrorists, and this is why it is natural that it is the intellectuals and the university people that are most sensitive towards this intellectual contradiction. I think this contradiction between what people, what the political elite says and how it justifies its actions, it simply insults the intelligence of the intelligentsia. And I think this is why the protests started in the universities.
Yeah, so what do you make of the key demands made by these protesters, and how do you think that's affecting public opinions or public discussions in the country?
I think, obviously different students, different staff members have different demands and different problems with the ongoing situation. Some are economic, some are military, some are political. It seems, though, that the most immediate demand is economic, and it's related to the economic ties universities may have with Israel and especially with the Israeli military. University students want to get rid of all of that, and it seems that this is what the Western media also emphasizes the most. But I think more broadly, I'm sure that that there are broader demands also to limit and cut U.S. public and private economic engagement with the Israeli war machine. But I'm a bit surprised that. That what is often presented as the first demand is related to mainly this economic thing, but clearly without U.S. military support, U.S. military aid and arms sales, Israel would not be able to conduct its military operations. And I'm quite sure that that many of the intellectuals in America are especially opposed to this military side of U.S.-Israeli relationship. And I think on the political realm, there's the fact that in words and declarations, the United States supports the two-state solution with the Palestinian state along with the Israeli state. Yet it tends to counteract the plan by vetoing Palestinian membership in the UN. I think this too is something that is a contradiction that intellectuals cannot live with.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think has led to the internationalization of these campus protests, particularly their spread to universities in the UK and Europe? And what are the key demands of the protesters in the UK, for example? Are they similar or different from those protesters in the US?
I think they're relatively similar. The demands, and I think the internationalization is caused by the very same thing that that has caused the original protests. Many of the European countries have participated and basically blindly followed the United States in the policy of support of Israel, and this is obviously problematic for many intellectuals and university people.
Mm-hmm. So how do you assess the Biden administration or the governments in Europe? How do you assess their handling of the protests on campuses? And do you anticipate any shifts in their policy towards Israel as a result of these protests?
I think the harsh measures against protests are problematic in democracies. Obviously, if people try to show what they think, that that shouldn't be met with harsh measures. I think what we are seeing is that security interests clash with the interests of democracy, and this is problematic, especially since the security apparatus of democracies is supposed to protect democracy. So now there is a contradiction between what they are trying to, what they should be doing, and what they are actually doing. So that's the first thing. And I think the immediate effect of these harsh measures is that there will be an internal debate about democracy. I mean, how can support of Israel prevent people from showing their own opinions? So that's the first thing. That's the immediate effect, I think. But I think there's also a likelihood that things will change in U.S. policy towards Israel. But I think it's more broadly because of the fact that that there is a public opinion against blind support of very aggressive policies. Biden administration will have hard time winning the presidential elections later this year if it goes so openly against the popular opinion. This way, I think the student protests simply exemplify popular opinion and the problem. They are not the main thing. The main thing is the popular opinion. But that's one thing. The other thing that I think may be even more important is that this policy in support of Israel's atrocity crimes will change, because eventually it will change because of geopolitical reasons. U.S. is currently consolidating opposition of the Muslim world against the West. Even countries like Indonesia and Malaysia that have normally been quite pro-U.S. Are now clearly outraged by what happens in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And this will, I mean, this means that the support of the Gaza operation costs the U.S. Dearly in geopolitical terms, and because of this cost, I think eventually things have to change.
Thank you, Timo Kivimaki, Professor of International Relations at University of Bath. U.S. economic growth was much slower than expected to start the year, and prices rose faster. Official data shows that gross domestic product increased at 1.6% annualized pace in the first quarter. It was the weakest pace since the second quarter of 2022. Meanwhile, U.S. inflation rose to 2.7% in the year to March, another sign that price pressures remain stubbornly high. How will these latest figures complicate the Federal Reserve's plan to cut interest rates? What do they say about the U.S. economy, and how can the U.S. deal with this national debt issue? To delve deeper into all these issues, my colleague Zhao Yang spoke with Aina Tiangyan, a senior fellow at Taihe Institute.
So, Aina, the U.S. first quarter GDP was much lower than expected at 1.6%, and also the inflation rose at a faster pace. So, what are the main factors behind it, and how do you describe the U.S. economy right now?
Well, it's not looking really good. You know, you need more data points. You can't just, you know, forecast the future on one data set. But this Q1 number is really, really worrying because, I mean, they're off by so much. You know, 1.6 to 2.7. I mean, that's 1.1 basis points. That is a lot. So right now, obviously, the federal debt is an issue. Commercial real estate, I'm hearing that around 20% of it is unoccupied. Remember, banks generally were giving non-recourse loans to these real estate developers in the back days, which means that all they can do is take the property. They can't go after the developer. So they're going to be hurt. Unemployment doesn't look as good as the figures show, because people are having real problem finding good paying jobs. They can certainly be an usher at the movie theater, but that's not going to pay the bills. And, you know, 60% of the American public, according to iInformation, there is paying 50% or more either for the rent or their mortgage. And this inflation is really hurting them. Mm. And, you know, it brings up the specter of stagflation. You know, UBS executive cautioned about one data point, but he said this is really bad and it could lead to something much worse.
Mm. And the inflation actually surpassed economists' expectations, and analysts say inflation is hot, it's getting sticky and more broad-based. So why is that, and how will it influence the Federal Reserve's decision on the pace and timing of interest rate cuts this year?
Well, it seems like most of the inflation is due to increases in wages not supported by productivity. And this causes prices on goods and services to increase because businesses have to pay their people more. You know, we saw last year the auto industry went on strike. They were able to get a 30% increase in their pay, but they didn't. That's not connected to a 30% increase in the productivity of U.S. cars. So this is always a classic situation, and it's not going to be fixed. Now, in terms of Powell, he's absolutely fixated on using interest rates to control inflation. But raising rates won't address the labor issue, you know, wage issues and things like this. So we'll need more data points. But if it comes in the same on the next quarter, you can bet there will be no rate cuts and a stagflation scenarios on the horizon. Mm. And remember, all of these, you know, all the markets were up tremendously, you know, in the last few weeks, hitting highs and everything like that. That was a bet on an expanding economy. Now they're going to have to rethink that. And it's really on the political side, not good for Biden to have a situation where things are going downhill when he's trying to convince people that he should get a second term.
And looking at the U.S. debt issue, Ina, and fiscal deficit, how do you describe the main problems of the U.S. debt issue? It's now over $34 trillion U.S. dollars. Debt, right?
Yeah, it is. And it just doesn't get any better. The problem is the Government Accountability Office. This is part of the U.S. government. They do basically an assessment, and they said that the U.S. is on an unsustainable path in terms of its fiscal management. They're looking to add about somewhere between $1.6 and $2 trillion each year to their existing deficit, which is $34 trillion. So instead of addressing the problem that they have, you know, all this money they need to pay back. What they're basically saying is we're just going to borrow more. And they're borrowing money to pay the interest on the loans that they already have on the $34 trillion. Mm. So this is, you know, you can't keep that up forever. That's the definition of a Ponzi scheme, where I borrow money to pay the interest on the money I borrowed from you. That's not good. It's going to be something that has to be watched very, very carefully.
And the IMF or the International Monetary Fund recently warned that huge U.S. Fiscal deficits have pumped up the inflation and posed a significant risk to the global economy. And it's also forecast the U.S. to get a fiscal deficit of 7.1% next year. So how alarming is it?
Well, it's very alarming. As I was saying before, the U.S. government's own accountability office says it's not sustainable. Now you're hearing it from the international forces. Remember, they got very excited that, you know, the U.S. government called out the rating agencies simply because they were recognizing that the U.S. has massive debts and no plan to pay them back. And, you know, they really went after them in the press, and they've exerted a lot of pressure. Quite frankly, I'm surprised that the rating agencies haven't truthfully downgraded U.S. debt, especially in view of this inflation and this, you know, adding $2 trillion each year to the deficit when you already have something that's unsustainable. Just doesn't make any sense. And it has huge repercussions internationally. Mm. If you have dollar-denominated loans, they're going to be, they continue to be very expensive. Hot money flows, people looking for some sort of yield, will be drawn to the U.S. But this money isn't going into creating factories and jobs. It's simply buying bonds. It's paying for some of the interest. But now the U.S. has to pay more interest because rates continue to be higher. So it's a downward negative spiral.
So what have actually contributed to the high fiscal deficit of the U.S.?
Well, wars and stimulus, you know, about $4 trillion worth just went to Afghanistan and Iraq. And then, you know, there hasn't been, they haven't balanced, the U.S. hasn't balanced its budget. That means the money that's taken in has not equaled the money going out since Clinton's presidency. And even before that, it never did anyway. So, I mean, there's only a few years where they're able to have a surplus budget. Those days are gone. They just spend and keep spending. And politically, there's no willpower to do anything about it. So it's not a good situation. And people should not be celebrating. The U.S. economy is extremely important. It's 4.5% of the world, but it's almost 20% of consumption. Even, you know, half that or a third of that went away, that would have disastrous effects worldwide. So there's this issue about how do you prop up the United States and ask them to start being responsible about their economic situation.
And for the U.S. economic ties with China, Tesla CEO Elon Musk arrived in Beijing on Sunday, and Chinese Premier Li Qiang met with him. And Premier Li said that the Tesla's development in China could be regarded as a successful example of China-U.S. economic and trade cooperation. So, Aina, how do you view it? And what does Tesla or Elon Musk want from the Chinese market?
Elon Musk is a master marketer, very good at seeing things. And what he says is, okay, I need a new idea. So it's, although it's not really new, this driverless taxi idea has, you know, he has a huge following. They say, oh, this sounds great. He's come to China because it's really in China. The government say, look, we're going to have driverless taxis here and there. You already have those in Beijing and different areas, and it will expand. You know, Chinese government show that the benefits of cooperation are greater than conflict.
That's Einar Tengen, a senior fellow at Taihe Institute. And that's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.